losing support except from a handful of countries that are not that significant.
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, there. Let's continue the conversation. I want to bring in Dr. Patel. Dr. Patel, you mentioned the weight of the United Nations, the legitimacy of the UN now being called into question. It's not the first time, is it? You remember the prelude to the Iraq War, many anti-Iran resolutions, but yet when it comes to a resolution that is supposed to stop bloodshed and stop Israel from carrying its genocidal campaign against Palestinians, somehow it doesn't happen.
You must recall that the United Nations' primary goal, of course it has many issues, but the primary issue is to bring about peace and to make sure there's no conflict. And it's failing in its primary objective, not because of the UN itself, but because of the structures of the UN that were itself created by the superpowers of the time, Britain, France, Russia, and United States of America, and to a certain extent, China. And what we have now is the United States of America repeatedly throughout the history of the United Nations, which coincides with the birth of the State of Israel or the Nakba, has supported Israel to continue with its colonization, its occupation. And this undermining, really, as I mentioned earlier, is dangerous for us, for the global society. But of course, for the immediate time, it means that there is a continuation of the loss of life in Gaza, the unfolding of the genocide. And, you know, every day, every hour we speak, more and more people are dying. So this is actually a very acute phase that we would hope that the United Nations would be able to trump the desires of the United States, unreserved support for Israel. And in a way, the General Assembly's vote shows that the world society wants that to happen. Yet now the only country that is obstructing that primarily is the United States of America.
What about you? What do you think, Dr. Waghar? The fact that the UN was created post-World War to prevent war from happening again, and it doesn't seem to be, at a time like this at least, living up to its purpose. It's not fit for purpose anymore. Should we move towards a world where we have a world body that works for everybody and not for certain powerful countries or countries that have powerful backers?
Yes, I actually pretty much agree with Mr. Patel with regards to the structure of the United Nations. Precisely, historically, it was created to actually prevent any other major world war from happening. But unfortunately, I mean, after the Second World War, we have been seeing skirmishes of war throughout the world. It's just not, you know, one major world war, but mostly most of the countries in particular regions are involved in some sort of, you know, wars.
Yeah.
The structure of United Nations, I think that's where the problem really is. When an organization that big is created by certain superpowers of that time, you will eventually see that the structure has some sort of, there will be certain loopholes for these superpowers to be able to maneuver in some way where they eventually, for instance, because my work is purely on nuclear non-proliferation, and when I look at the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I think that it's one of the biggest hypocritical treaty, because you have all the nations who already have nuclear stockpile,
you know, arsenals,
declared as or known as the nuclear states, whereas you have certain, you know, articles within the treaty which allows some of the states to actually get some sort of nuclear know-how for energy purposes, for peaceful purposes.
Such as Iran.
Precisely. And hence, in those ways, you'll see that there are so many loopholes which have been created to be able for the countries who aspire to grow to be actually stopped on the steps.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I think it's the structure of how the Permanent Security Council is. I think it should be evolved. Why do we have just the five? Why can't we have other growing or emerging, you know, nations apart? Or actually, the Security Council should grow as the world is economically growing.
And because of the fact that it's not growing, and certain powers such as, again, the U.S., the U.K., old backers of Israel, have the wield veto power in the Security
in their hands,
Council
yes,
that allows Israel to continue with its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians for as long as it wishes.
True.
And whenever it wishes to do so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if one party to the Security Council vetoes, obviously, that's where the problem is. Yeah. And that's what we are seeing right now.
We're going to pivot to what we heard earlier, the groundswell of support for Palestinians, through international solidarity with Palestinians here in the UK and beyond. I'll start with Dr. Patel. You have helped organize these protests that we have seen over the past more than 2 months. How did you do it to bring out so many people? And also, what kind of impact do you think these protests have had on the political establishment here?
First, let me say it's interesting to see someone who's doing a PhD of some of the work that we are doing in our lifetime. So I think that's quite encouraging that we must be doing something right. But going back to your question, really, I think it's a long-term impact of the work that has been done for over the past few decades. I mean, we've been around for nearly 30 years now, PSC even longer, and we're the two main, if you like, bodies that are then surrounded with another four organizations. And united, we have been able to make sure that the issue of Palestine remains within the psyche of the British public. And I think that has been very important, because when major events like the attack on Gaza takes place, then the people are mobilized and they're very well informed of the situation. And they can see, they understand the context of the situation and the dangers. Because when we say in our marches that we are all Palestinians, it is not simply an affiliation of loyalty, but it literally means that we, even in Britain, in a way are suffering what the Palestinians are going through at much lesser scale. And what I mean by that is that while the Palestinians are being bombed and killed, a very high price being paid by them, we in Britain are being denied our freedom of speech, or freedom of democratic rights, the freedom of expressing ourselves. And this curtailing of our freedom here are reflected because of our support for the Palestinians, and hence the slogan, "We are all Palestinians." So it has a very big resonance of between us and the Palestinians. And the other thing to remember is those people who are shouting these slogans, most of them have no religious affiliation, no political affiliation. They don't even know most probably where Palestine is on the map, but they can feel the human essence and the suffering of the Palestinians and their denial that can be resonated with themselves, the underprivileged here in Britain. And I think those are the things that brings us together. And this is one of the many reasons, if you like, that you see so many people coming out. And something amazing about the demonstrations in Britain, that it encompasses almost all people of the different genres that are made up in the British society, from ethnic minorities to the conservative, if you like, not the political sense, but city dwellers to village dwellers. You have people white, black, you have socialist to other political spectrum. And you have all these people coming together for understanding that what is happening to the Palestinians is an injustice on a grand scale, or from different aspects of occupation, colonialism, the humanitarian violation, and the negation of international law, and all these aspects, I think, feed into it. But to go back to your original questions, the only reason we're able to bring out so many people is because of the long-term work that we have been doing ourselves and the other sister organizations with us.
Well, keep up the great work, because you've done very well. And also, I think it's the multiculturalness, as you mentioned, of these protests that is not going down well with the right-wing political establishment here, and definitely not in the halls of power in Tel Aviv. Dr. Waghar, we heard what the UA top policy chief, foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, had to say. From the American President Joe Biden off camera, expressing concern about the casualties and even saying that Israel is losing popular support, as if it had massive popular support around the world. Is it really because of the sheer scale of the Palestinian casualties? Or is it perhaps in the Western world there is an appetite to a certain point to really take this number of casualties and then before they call for a ceasefire or some kind of action, or asking Israel on the one hand, of course, to exercise restraint while on the other hand providing it with all the weaponry it needs to carry on?
One of the most interesting, I think, things that I have noticed about this whole issue with regards to this conflict is that most of the colonial, past colonial powers are the ones who are pretty much supportive of Israel and pretty much, you know, the ones who are actually funding in whatever way they can in terms of their own national interest as well as obviously Israel's interests. I do think that the major powers have an appetite for something like that, because when they see something going to this mass scale, I think also at the same point we have some mounting international pressure coming from all, you know, parts of the world. And hence, I suppose that Biden is kind of obviously becoming quite unpopular in his own country. And perhaps by the next election, he's definitely out.
Sorry to interrupt, but this change, it means that they're not necessarily concerned about Palestinian lives. It's about their own politics.
That is absolutely
internally.
Correct. Yes, absolutely correct. It's about their own politics. It's about their own interests. It has nothing to do with whatever is happening with the Palestinian people. Mm. I mean, had they even an ounce of humanity in them, they could have actually just, along with the other international...
Who helped prolong the ceasefire.
Precisely. So I do think that it's always to do with their own interests. And like I said, again, I'm reiterating the fact that these are all post-colonial powers,
yes.
You know, who have, you know, gone into certain countries, taken out the indigenous population and made their own, mark. So it's quite a...
And hence the designation of Israel as a settler colonial entity.
Precisely.
In that part of the
yes.
world.
Yes.
All right. That's all the time we have for this program. With those comments, we're going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza under attack. We'll be back with more. Until then, keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's speech. Attention to spiritual values is the key to safeguarding the Islamic system. When a person cannot feel what it is to be poor, what it is to be hungry, he cannot think of the poor and the hungry. However, those that have been reared in this same society and have felt what it is to be poor, they have seen and tasted poverty, they have felt it, and so they can attend to the connection of the poor. We must strive to maintain this circumstance in all of us. Devotion to Allah must be safeguarded in our legislative assembly, in our government bodies, and our holy warriors.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. We succeeded because of our power of faith that made everyone of us in all strata cry out for Islam, not because of number or figure. The sentence we just listened to is about the significant role of faith in victory. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi discerned faith of so much significance that he introduced it as a major criteria for success. You know, faith is the unique element which can give such strength to the human spirit and so expand the area of its activity as to prepare it to face the hardest and most complex of problems without giving in or cowering. The person imbued with faith knows that hardship, no matter how severe, will not stand in front of his undefeatable spirit and will overcome. The strength to bear hardship and adversity saves man from certain psychic illnesses. It is the power of faith which definitely increases a person's capacity for forbearance without affecting his mental equilibrium and his steadiness on the path of his goal. The Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam considered this merit as one of the characteristics of godly men. He said, "The man of faith is like gold. If placed in the furnace, it grows red and hot. And if it is weighed afterwards, its weight is not diminished in the least."
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Imam Ali alayhi salam also said, "The spirit of a person possessing faith is more resistant than the hardest stone." Well, both of these precious words and hadith signify the value that faith adds to the soul of a person. You know, sincere faith is fruitful when coupled with character. Hence, those who separate faith from works, their hopes of success will never be fulfilled. It is action and effort which rescue one from the valley of loss and failure. Okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Spring of the Truth has come to its end. I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears." Thank you.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Dear listeners, we have reached the 55th verse of chapter Nur.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وعد الله الذين آمنوا منكم وعملوا الصالحات ليستخلفنهم في الأرض كما استخلف الذين من قبلهم وليمكنن لهم دينهم الذي ارتضى لهم وليبدلنهم من بعد خوفهم أمنا يعبدونني لا يشركون بي شيئا ومن كفر بعد ذلك فأولئك هم الفاسقون.
Allah has promised those who have believed among you and done righteous deeds that He will surely grant them succession to authority upon the earth, just as He granted it to those before them, and that He will surely establish for them therein their religion, which He has preferred for them, and that He will surely establish for them, after their fear, security, for they worship Me, not associating anything with Me. But whoever disbelieves after that, then those are the defiantly disobedient.
As we said, the totality of the verse suggests that there are three promises by the Almighty Allah that will be bestowed on those Muslims who have faith and do good deeds, of course, accompanying each other. And this is one of those prerequisites that we have mentioned a lot during our previous programs, that this is the condition for the acceptance of the deeds. So deeds do come from righteous beliefs, and righteous beliefs are the ones that produce good deeds. So three things are promised to those true believers: succession over the earth, establishing the religion of truth everywhere, and abolishing all factors that cause fear for these people. Now, regarding this verse, there are some points to be mentioned. The first is the commentary of the Quranic sentence, as He appointed successors, those before them. So in the beginning of the verse, one of the promises made to the believers who have righteous deeds and beliefs altogether is that they will be successors in the earth. But there is a kind of similitude here. Just as He appointed successors those before them. What is the meaning of this? Regarding this, commentators have different opinions about the matter, that to whom this sentence refers, that they had got authority on the earth before Muslims. So this is an important question. Some say that it refers to Adam, David, and Solomon, Because in the 30th verse of Surah Al-Baqarah, we read about Adam, that verily I am appointing on the earth a deputy. Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa, the Almighty Allah says. And it is said about David in one of the verses of the Holy Quran that it was said unto him, O David, verily we have sent you a victory in the earth. And since Solomon was the heir of David's authority, he became the caliphate on the earth, and Solomon was David's heir. But some other commentators, like Allama Tabatabai, says in Al-Mizan that this concept is improbable because he does not consider the sentence those before them, الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ, to be proper or prophets. For this sentence has not been used for prophets in the Holy Quran. Therefore, it refers to some nations that were faithful and did good deeds and became the rulers on the earth.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So we said that the meaning of those before them, كَمَا اسْتَقْلَفَ الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ, is unknown and we are not sure of it. Some commentators believe that it is the previous prophets like Adam, David, and Solomon. But some others, like Allama Tabatabai, believe that this word has not been used for prophets in the Holy Quran, الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ. So this word, الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ, is necessarily referring to some nations before them. However, some others believe that this verse refers to the children of Israel who achieved authority on the earth when Moses, عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَآلِهِ وَعَلِيهِ السَّلَامِ, appeared and Pharaoh was defeated. As it is mentioned in chapter A'raf, where it says, and we made the people who were abased the inheritors to the east of the land and the west of it, which we had blessed therein. It is also said about them, the believers of the children of Israel, that it is said in the Holy Quran, and to grant them power in the earth. So this is another possibility. It is true that there were some wicked and insincere people among the children of Israel, but government was in the hand of the righteous believers. Therefore, the fault that some commentators find with this commentary is rejected. However, this third commentary seems more probable and more correct. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be
saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Aperture.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor. Its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But why? Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. And we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with disarmament of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world.
Just transmitted at the request of the...
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching the nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. A barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
They said don't go off the road, shoot your ass. Military zone, no photography.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona Nuclear Plant.
That's the gate. Go inside.
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona Nuclear Plant. All of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
There was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a big center of research, what it was called, civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph while the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time the security eye was not that strong, so I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of...
This message is transmitted at the request of the Israeli nuclear plant.
When President Kennedy took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the U.S. Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the six floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we traveled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xantha Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xantha Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona. Its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money,
but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what condition. And also the doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is more better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take land samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel? And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they're more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. This and many other cases come from the same region.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's been an honor for all of us to be able to benefit from the teachings of Sayyida Fatima and her household to talk about raising Fatimiyun. Now, before I begin my portion, I do want to thank and appreciate, and I think all of us, inshallah, to appreciate all of those who've contributed. In particular, I'd like to mention those or that we remember and pray for those who recited Latmiya and those who recited poetry for us. Brothers and sisters, there's a secret, and there's a reason why there's pushback. Your victory and your victory and your protection is in your youth connecting the dots, not shying away from the truth. Sayyida Fatima, that qiyam that she did was to get us to stand up for the truth, not just to have it in our hearts, but to connect the dots. If it's only one person, if it's only Sayyida Zahra, then they can kick in the door. When it's us as a community when this is how we think as a people, that's when we're a step closer to the victory. So there's a reason why some would not want us to mention our shuhada, to not think or talk or expound on the concept of martyrdom, not for that to be a goal in raising our children. Because that's your victory. That's your protection. So when I would hear the Latmiya being recited and the dots being connected, instead of this being a Fatimiya, where literally we come in and from day one till the end, we make no connection with the dunya, with the dhalimeen, with the modern day oppressors of Sayyidah Fatima. For me, that's a shame. The opposite is what everybody should be doing. The question should be on others. How come you can mention Sayyidah Zahra and talk about shahada of her and martyrdom and sacrificing yourself, and then have the audacity not to mention the wali of the time, not to mention the shimmer of the time, to make it a story and a fable and feel good and go home? That's the mistake. So for me, when I hear the poetry of our sister, the Latmiya that's being recited, that for me, I know that's a victory. Now it's in the hearts, minds, thoughts, and words of the believers. So inshallah, Allah reward all of those who are involved in this in any capacity and raise them with our mother, Sayyidah Fatima, salamullahi alayha. What Allah has given us right now is the tawfiq to spend several nights talking about just one of the techniques of our mother. Remember, our mother is someone who Angel Jibra'il from heaven, according to some of our hadith, the highest of the malaika is Jibra'il. Her spiritual station was so high that Jibra'il came to her door to console her, to talk to her. Jibra'il. If she were a man, not would she be one of the prophets, one of the Ulul Azm prophets. That means that our mother, who could have been leading the ummah from the outward stage, this person turned her focus to raising children, being a wife. That's the station of motherhood. The result of that are those champions. The result of that, and inshallah, we're going to be using some lessons from the students, the direct students of Sayyidah Fatima. So inshallah, we benefit. We can prepare ourselves and our children to be, inshallah, those elite soldiers of the Imam of the time. Now, brothers and sisters, very briefly, we would like to go to Sayyidah Fatima. And we hope that may Allah raise all of us to be Fatimi. If we could be Fatimi, if we could defend the wali of the time, if we could connect the dots and not be afraid. That's what Fatima was. Night after night, our mother would go door to door. All of that honor that she had gained in the time of Rasulullah, she's putting it out there to people who don't respect her. She told them, she said, help me, assist Allah's religion. She went to Ma'ath. She told Ma'ath, she said, help Allah's deen. I'm the daughter of your prophet. Ma'ath said, is there anybody else? She said, nobody else came. He said, well, then there's no benefit in me coming either.